This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
When I first came to Melbourne, I was living south of the river. Don't know if that's controversial for you, but anyway, people hounded me to get north side, in particular to see one street. You don't know Melbourne till you know Brunswick Street, they said. So I went and my eyes were opened to the north side's eclectic, slightly edgy bohemian appeal through that street. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And as Mario's celebrates its 40th year, we wanted to celebrate the almost 200-year-old iconic street that it sits on. What are your memories and stories about Brunswick Street, Fitzroy? It's iconic. So many parts of our lives were there, particularly in the 70s and the 80s. Were you part of that groovy, artistic crowd? What do you remember? Did you maybe travel from outside if you don't live in Melbourne? Did you travel particularly to see Brunswick Street? What are the best places there? We do know about Mario's, but what else have you loved on Brunswick Street, Fitzroy? Also this hour, is your boss monitoring you? And what's stopping them from using AI to do it? Today, a special forum of government, employers and union reps are meeting for the first time to look at AI in the workplace and looking at it particularly through the lens of trust, capability, transparency and safety. Among other things, they're going to be talking about employers and surveillance. Tell me if your boss is already monitoring you. We already know about things like on-screen activity, measuring keystrokes and so forth. We've even heard about laptops at home becoming covert listening devices. And apparently that's not even using AI. That's just part of the technology. So what could be happening with AI? 1300 222 774, if you want to tell me about the monitoring in your workplace and what you think we should do with AI. There's no national strategy to guard what the AI can do potentially into the future in the Australian workplace. Are we doing the same thing with AI that we did with social media, letting it develop unheeded? Also this hour, why is the news overnight that the UAE is leaving OPEC is good news for you? Did you even think about that? Maybe you don't understand. We will have an explainer for you. And also, have you ever thought about the state of your kids' mouth guards, or can't you even bear to? We will have some important news for that. But next, is your boss monitoring you, and what can be done about bots watching us as we work?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, the federal government is going to be meeting with employers and unions today to examine the adoption of AI in workplaces. And part of that conversation will be informed by what my next guests have seen. Matt O'Kane is Managing Director of the Notion Digital Forensics and does some work with the University of New South Wales as well. And he joins me now. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Mary.
Tell us, what is the state of play at the moment when it comes to AI monitoring people in the workplace?
So right now, there is monitoring that happens in the workplace, and most people would probably be okay with it. We're logging things to protect us for cybersecurity and for insurance purposes, like email, gateways and web filtering and things like that. And most people would say that's basic hygiene. So when it comes to AI in the workplace, what people might think about is monitoring of keyboard strokes and what's on screens. And that's kind of, it hasn't really come up publicly in Australia yet, but it's something that could potentially come from overseas.
That's interesting, because I do know people who have said that they have had their keystrokes monitored already. It particularly happened, I think, after people were working from home. And I also remember talking to corporations, one corporation in particular that said it was going to do it, they said in order to measure productivity, just as a, you know, information gathering exercise. But you don't believe that it's been proven to happen?
Well, no, definitely. We've seen deployment of keystroke monitoring and screens already pre-AI going out.
Right.
And, you know, that's controversial. It depends on the situation. Most people would say it's okay to collect information to investigate serious incidents. But there probably needs to be a wider conversation about how to deploy it on an ongoing monitoring basis. And when you've got keyboard monitoring and screen monitoring on an ongoing basis before AI, the constraint was a manager being able to go in and actually monitor things. But with AI, sometimes that constraint can be removed because AI never loses concentration. It never loses focus. It can monitor everything. And I think this is the kind of the conversation we need to have now.
We are talking to Matt O'Kane, who's from Notion Digital Forensics. We're talking about AI in the workplace. 1300 222 774 if you'd like to join the conversation. Matt, at the moment, what guardrails are around the adoption of AI in the workplace?
Well, I think that I don't want to get into legal discussions, but what I will say is that whatever is deployed as AI, the person deploying it still remains responsible. So just because it's AI doesn't mean that the person pushing it out loses the responsibility. If you're going to put an AI out into your workplace or to your computer system, you need to test it and look at its governance and be happy that it's acting what you'd want it to act in your name. So just like we'd have an employee, we train an employee up, we want to make sure that we've thought about what this AI should do. And we want to try and avoid just simply pulling AIs from overseas, which have different workplace rules and workplace cultures, and just deploying them here.
What's the worst case scenario in this situation, do you think, Matt?
Look, I think that the worst case scenario is, as a community, we don't get that balance right. I think we need a bit of monitoring in terms of workplace safety. You know, we want to be able to detect serious problems and serious misconduct, right? But I think where we need a discussion as a community is, you know, how much monitoring do we want to have at a micro level, at a day-to-day level, for things that might not rise to that serious level? And that's kind of a discussion that we probably need to have, just so as a community, we set the boundaries and we make sure that, you know, before we deploy the AIs, we're very clear on how we want it to act in our day.
Adam has called in from Cowes. Adam, what did you want to say?
Hello. I just wanted to say that monitoring is an issue that does need to be addressed, but more so job redundancies and whether or not the profits that are made from the companies that are using AI are being circulated back into the economy so that that person that loses their job isn't forever constantly trying to have to reshape their image. Because as far as I'm aware, AI is already a major input into society, but it would benefit only the minority who are already rich.
Oh, that's an interesting point, Adam. Thank you for that. Matt, this really is a balancing act, isn't it?
Look, I think it is. I think that, we've got to be across it. I think that we want to be careful in Australia. The whole world is moving forward rapidly on AI. And I've spent some time recently with some coders overseas and I'm sort of seeing how it's being deployed, you know, outside of Australia. And, you know, we need to move with them. And we also need to understand how that impacts people so we can sort of, as we transition to keep up with the rest of the world, we're taking the community with us. That's outside of my expertise. That's a complex issue. Maybe some of your listeners will have some ideas there.
Matt, that's a good thought. Thank you so much for joining me today, Matt. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
That's Matt O'Kane, who's Managing Director of Notion Digital Forensics. Well, in fact, there was a piece of work done by the John Curtin Research Centre, and I'm going to be talking to someone who put that together. But Phil, you've called in from Cowes. What did you want to say?
Hello, yes. I just want to talk about in the construction industry, AI has already been introduced on safety matters where the safety, like security cameras, look at what people are doing. If it's unsafe, now I can understand the reason why, but some people makes them a little bit nervous to know they're getting spied on, you know.
So does this happen in your workplace, Phil?
Yes.
And what have they said to you about the privacy issue?
Oh, well, there is none. If you want the job, you just accept it. That's the whole idea. You know, you just got to accept it. But AI, I'm very worried about AI. I seen something on YouTube the other day because I'm in the geopolitics. Now, these two different gentlemen were saying about the Iran war when they said X amount of ships have been blown up. But it turned out to be it was all false. And I think if you're a person sitting there listening to this, you think your mum, dad or whoever may have been on one of these ships. Do you know what I mean? They were faking people's faces and they were faking their voices. And also I get a little bit worried that can law enforcement are digitalised to give you, get a confession out you when you actually haven't said it too.
Phil, you've wrapped a lot of worries that we do have about AI in there. Thank you for calling in. And yes, the idea that you are spied on at work and yet there's this fake slop as well that you can generate through AI. Maybe you can make a fake you at work. My next guest might be able to tell me if that's even possible. Dominic Ma is co-author of the AI in the Workplace report that the government will be drawing on as well. Thank you for joining me today, Dominic.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me, the report that you co-authored has called for a number of measures that you think are needed for us as a country to put guardrails around AI. What are the most important ones?
Well, I would actually just right now endorse some of the comments that we just heard. The last one from Phil about how AI is being used through surveillance in construction, that would be a form of scope creep. And this is a situation where the AI is monitoring surveillance footage in order for it to provide security for the site, but it's being redirected into a kind of performance management, it sounds like, in this case, right, where you know, the AI is not just looking like, is something dangerous happening, but are people doing their job properly? And, you know, if that's not what it's been designed for or if that's not how it's being configured properly, you know, it could be producing inference and reports that aren't really within its established expertise, or it doesn't have the proper information to make those inferences.
How would you tease that out, though, if it's simply a camera that is detecting, for instance, certain movements and maybe the algorithm is about the unhealthy movements? How would you even construct that algorithm to not be about work performance or any of these unexpected elements?
That's exactly right. And essentially what this boils down to is accountability, right? So AI, if you're outsourcing your management decisions to AI, it's still your decision, right? You're just using a tool to help you come up with a decision, and the human has to own the decision, right? And that means they have to be accountable for whether it's a good decision, whether it's taking into consideration appropriate measures and observations, whether those have been conducted fairly, and whether people have a reasonable chance to contest them. And so that comes back to, you know, the same situation with working from home. You know, the previous guest was talking about keyloggers, and the same kind of thing happens. It can collect a lot of data, and then it can draw inferences based on that. And it's not just how you type, but maybe how you look. If you know, do you look tired? You know, if the camera's picking up that you're, you know, a bit slow today, your eyes are droopy, maybe your hair's not done properly. You know, it could even pick up, in some cases, it could recognize pregnancy from skin tone.
Oh.
Or it could recognize your religion from the background of, you know, what books you have on the shelf or something like this. And it could start drawing in conclusions about things like this that aren't really the employer's business and aren't really the AI's instructions. But, you know, if you haven't set it up very carefully, it could start including those kind of information into a report about how you're doing your work. And once that's produced as a report, you know, a manager has to sit there and say, you know, and override it and justify why they've overridden a report from the AI. Right?
Yeah.
Whereas normally it just would never come up because it's not their business.
Right. So employers so needing to choose to protect their workers' privacy rather than it being actually entrenched.
And choose to not act on something that they've now discovered when they shouldn't have.
We're talking about...
So there are serious safeguards that they need to put in place to make sure that this is done in a way that is working with staff and managers together so that the workplace becomes somewhere that everyone wants to be and that, you know, people are doing great work
and
rather than feeling, you know, supervised and this sort of chilling effect.
Indeed. And I want to get to what you think should happen, but also Lisa has called in from Glen Iris. What are you concerned about, Lisa?
Just my experience. I work in a big public hospital, And a couple of years ago when I claimed some overtime, I've actually done more overtime than what I claimed, and the manager said that asked me about it and said, oh, they'd looked at the last keystroke on my computer, and that was before I'd written the last hour that I was in the hospital. And I said, well, actually, what you haven't taken into account is there are still paper-based patients, of which I saw three after that last keystroke. I don't know whether it was true or whether it was just kind of intimidation.
How did you feel when they were saying that to you, Lisa?
Look, in this place, it could be either. But yeah, I just pointed that out. I mean, seriously, think about it first and check what the claim actually was.
I've got to ask you, Lisa, have you from now then on just kept putting random keystrokes into your computer as you leave work?
I don't actually like that system.
Yeah.
And the way that things have done, I think it makes people not write as comprehensive notes.
Mm.
I used to handwrite all of my notes for all the patients, but we just don't have time. So now a lot of the juniors actually do that on your behalf, which isn't great medico-legally, I wouldn't think.
Yeah.
But otherwise the work just couldn't be done. I've not heard of that happening to anybody else.
No. Lisa, thank you so much. That first-hand experience, Dominic, is so important.
Yeah.
Dominic, what is your report calling for? What is needed in Australia?
Well, the thing that we're most focused on calling for is to understand that Australia has spent a lot of time over decades working out how to make our workplaces fair, how to make Australia a great country to live in and to go up and to work in. And the institutions that we've set up and the rules that we've established shouldn't be thrown out just because there's a new form of technology. But you wouldn't throw out workplace safety laws just because they introduced a forklift as a new technology, and nor should you throw out, you know, workplace fairness or safety laws for AI. And, you know, the situation that we just heard there, that's a kind of situation where there's a sort of overreach of inference and maybe a false precision in terms of how things are being managed, and that could potentially be a form of bullying in the management, right, where there's this persistent intrusive monitoring that can become a sort of repeated and unreasonable behavior. And so, you know, that's an example where, you know, that would potentially be a breach of the Fair Work
Of the Fair Work and have to be really knitted into that, yeah.
Yeah, and so what we're really calling for is to reinvest in all the institutions that manage those, what makes things fair and great, and make sure that they're updated for dealing with this current round of technology.
Yep. George has called in from Rosebud. What did you want to say, George?
Well, I was wondering actually what is AI and how does it work?
Oh, a really good basic question. Thank you, George. Dominic, while I've got you on the phone, what would you say to George or anyone listening who's, you know, a bit confused? And I get that point. There are so many things, as I said, that are already part of our software in the machines. What is AI and what does it mean that goes above and beyond the capability of the computers that we work with already?
Yeah, sure. It is a really great question. It can be hard to answer things, you know, in terms of how do you define it. But this, I would say a large part of this started, you know, a few decades ago, really, with you know, neural networks. And it's a way of pattern recognition for computers, essentially.
Right.
You give it a lot of information and you say, this is how to recognize this information. And you reward it when it gets the answer correct, and you know, give it a negative reinforcement when it gives the wrong answer, and it starts learning how to give right answers. And it does it billions and billions of times until it really starts working out statistically, you know, this is what I should do next when I see this kind of input. So it's really just a very sophisticated statistical analysis process where it guesses what response you want to see when you give it some input. But it's become so good that it's really very difficult to distinguish from a quite qualified human.
George, I hope that explains it. It is something that we are all grappling with, what it can do and indeed what it will be able to do. Dominic Maher, thank you so much for your time this morning.
My pleasure.
That's Dominic Maher, who's co-author of the Workplace Report, and that forum is meeting today. Your thoughts, AI monitoring is unethical, says this texter. This one, AI is currently being deployed with the company's interests at heart. This will not go well for society. Stop monitoring workers' minutes and start monitoring throughput instead. It's a much better test of a person's worth to the company. And Marnie from Beaumaris says, before we allow active monitoring with AI, we need to ensure the correct psychological safety legal protections are in place. So we'll keep an eye on that task force. It sounds like we're all very much invested when we have to be, don't we? We've been celebrating Mario's this week with its 40th anniversary, but we wanted to look at memories of Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, the street that Mario sits on. Already Andrew in East Gippsland is saying the iconic Black Cat Cafe in Brunswick Street. What are your memories? What are your stories about Brunswick Street?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
What are your memories of Brunswick Street? What does it mean to you? As I said, when I first came to Melbourne, I was told you just don't know Melbourne until you get to know Brunswick Street. And indeed, for what it's worth, it drew me up to the north side and I am there now. Tell me what you think of Brunswick Street, what it's meant to you over the years. Joining me to celebrate it is David Nichols, who is Professor of Urban Planning at Melbourne University. Hi, David.
Hi, Mary. How are things?
Good, thank you. You're a fan of Brunswick Street?
Oh, long-time fan. I first started going to Brunswick Street when I was in my late teens, which is the early 80s. And back then, it was, you know, I feel like, and the perceptions can be strange, but I feel like I witnessed that boost that it got in the early 80s, because my memory of Brunswick Street in, say, 81, 82 was that it was completely, you know, derelict. It was a lot of empty shops, a lot of, you know, if not literally boarded up, then certainly not functioning as shops. And over a few short years, it really came alive.
Yeah. And that was that particular boom. I'd love to know if you were there before that boom or after that boom. 1300 222 774, have you seen Brunswick Street change over the years? Looking back, David, it's one of Melbourne's oldest streets, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. Well, Fitzroy is the oldest suburb of Melbourne, yeah, and Brunswick Street is its spine for sure.
So how did it start off?
How did it start off? It was 1840s subdivision, as I say, Melbourne's first suburb, so It came into being quickly. It was, you know, there was some beautiful, there's a wonderful history book that was published by the Cullen History Society probably 30 years ago now, but has a lot of great pictures of very early Brunswick Street with big houses in it, you know, big suburban houses that, you know, aren't really there anymore or not there at all. But it was sort of a, you know, classic suburban street.
Martin from Penshurst has texted saying he had his 18th birthday at the Afghan restaurant in Brunswick Street. It was in the harem room. Such a great night. David, we've seen the anniversary, the birthday, a 40th birthday of Mario's there, but there have been some really iconic places, haven't there? Some still there, but some in our past.
Yeah. Some still there. And your correspondent there mentioned the Black Cat, which is, of course, you know, was one of those early 80s places that was really a kind of a signpost, a milestone, I don't know what you'd call it, but it was an anchor point in the revival of Brunswick Street's fortunes. I'd like to put a shout out to Baker's, sometimes known as Baker's Restaurant, but more commonly known as Baker's Cafe, which in my memory is a little earlier than Mario's, just a little bit earlier. I think Baker's might have moved up the street and Mario's moved into its premises. But
what Baker's do you remember about it, David?
It was the first time I was ever exposed to that idea of all-day breakfast,
which is a thing.
Probably was a thing before. So, you know, I was quite young, so maybe it was just a coincidence. But that kind of idea of, you know, it's a cafe where you could be, you could sort of install yourself there for a period of hours if you wanted to. You know, and people who, you know, bohemians.
Bohemians.
I was calling them bohemians. I don't want to put inverted commas on it. Let's just say that's what they were.
Let's embrace it.
Would happily hang out there.
Yeah. Well, where did the bohemian kind of influence come from? Is that just part of gentrification, part of that process?
It's sort of a predecessor to gentrification proper, almost in almost every case. So some of your listeners might have been familiar, or you might be familiar with a beautiful book that came out a few years ago, Robert Ashton's photographs, called Brunswick 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Fitzroy 1974. I always get confused, Brunswick Street, Fitzroy. Fitzroy 1974, and a fabulous book. And that shows a lot of that sort of that intersection between, so there's a lot of non-English speaking migrants, the Housing Commission towers in Brunswick Street, the large Aboriginal presence in Gertrude Street,
mm-hmm.
and then there are, you know, artists, students, etc. So that's the 70s. And then going into the 80s, you have, you know, house values start to rise, people start to, you know, pay a little bit extra for the privilege of living in what had been thought of largely as a slum area, and its fortunes start to reverse. So there's that, you know, I mean, I think, once again, this is my perspective, but I see it as a kind of a sweet spot in the 80s into the early 90s, mm-hmm. when there are people around, you know, spending the money, so keeping the shopping strip alive and the kind of entertainment elements of Brunswick Street alive, but it's still affordable for more artistic,
getting those young
artistically inclined people.
Mm. Yep, so many rentals around there too. Once when you could actually afford it, that's once upon a time. Lots of texts coming in about the 80s. Sam, you've called in from Ringwood. You lived in Brunswick Street, is that right?
Yes, I lived in Brunswick Street in the late 70s.
Ah, so before this process.
Before this process, and
it was
just beginning, and I'm a musician, and I was in an act that played at the Flying Trapeze Cafe. That was probably one of the best things happening in Brunswick Street at that time, and that was run by John Pinder, because he went off to do The Last Laugh over many years. But you could go out onto Brunswick Street and look down the whole length, and there would be nothing. And on a cold winter's day, you'd have to wait hours for a tram, and it was very desolate. And
oh, wow. You could probably even park then.
You could.
I
you
wish
could
you can't
park.
Now.
and there was one restaurant called Mother Tucker's. I think that was about it. And there was soul food. And that was sort of the extent of the kind of shopping there and restaurants and things like that. But it was great to see it grow.
Yeah, so you saw the sort of the transformation. How long did you stay there, Sam?
I stayed there quite a few years, but I mean, over my time, I lived in and around the area and been always frequenting it, and you know, very very friendly place and great place it is. But it's just, you know, I was probably 17, 18, and had it been as funky as it is now, I would have been very happy. It was quite desolate in its day, but
oh, that's interesting and really, something that we can't even really quite imagine, Sam. Thank you so much for joining the conversation. This from Carmel in Malvern East. The ABC introduced me to Brunswick Street. I've been to Friday Reviews with Jacinta and Brian and the fantastic fundraiser for Oz Harvest last year, and thank you. Oh, well. You're welcome on behalf of Jacinta and Brian. This from Patty. I worked at Cafe Umago for 5 years in the early 2000s. Still have lifelong friends from that time. And sad when Brunswick Street Festival stopped. It was a ripping party. This as well, a couple of texts about Raw Studios, a pioneering 1980s artist-run cooperative and gallery in Fitzroy, provided a vital platform for emerging female and Indigenous artists. That's from Christine in Richmond. That sounds like, you know, really underlines, David, doesn't it, the cultural importance of Brunswick Street and so much that happened there.
Raw. Definitely was a major force at the time. The Universal Theatre. There were many places like that around there in the early 80s. I mean, look, it's so proximate to the city. You could walk from the CBD. It's all of those elements that people desire. Most definitely, yeah. Let's take the inverted commas off Bohemian, and let's just say that's what it was.
Let's embrace it, absolutely. Michael from Caroline Springs says, I drive Uber on the weekends and picked up passengers four times on a Saturday night a few weeks ago. I remember thinking the broad range of demographics I'd picked, and I thought to myself, I love this town. That's good that you can go in and still see that as well.
Yeah.
As I say, you still can't park there. Bill, you've called in from Seaford. What do you remember of Brunswick Street?
Well, I lived around the corner in Marnie Street, and I used to do the family shopping on the Saturday morning. Mm. And in those days, Brunswick Street was entirely different. This is the mid-50s. I mean, there was, you know, on the corner there was a milk bar, then there was a newsagent, then there was a fish and chip shop, then there was a dry cleaners. Across the road there were Chandler's Hardware store. That was the equivalent of Bunnings in the old days. So it was a totally different place.
Yeah.
Totally different.
I've got another text, Bill, saying, talking about the fish and chip shop. There wasn't much more than that in a grocery and fruit shop owned by the parents of Cherie, the creator of Flowers Vazette. I love the historians amongst us, Bill. Thank you so much for calling in. Anita, you've called in from Menzies Creek. What do you remember?
Well, the thing I wanted to point out was that there were some places just off Brunswick Street that were crucial to this early development. One of them in particular was when the Universal Workshop was established in Victoria Street and 3RRR moved into that building. And so you had this broadcaster broadcasting from around the corner from Mario's. Everybody who came to 3RRR went to Mario's for coffee. All the musicians who came in went to Mario's for coffee.
Yeah.
And the other place was the Last Laugh Cafe, the Last Laugh Restaurant.
Of course.
Now, that was also established in that very early era and, again, brought all that Rod Quantock kind of humour and that counterculture. So the bohemian growth around the Brunswick Street was actually a big driver for making Brunswick Street become more and more energised.
And fed so much into our culture. Anita, thank you. That is a great lot of memories. David, you know, when I started by saying I was told that you didn't know Melbourne until you knew Brunswick Street, it sounds pretty much like it is a powerhouse of the culture of the whole state.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in many ways. Well, look, the RRR influence, the Universal Workshop. I said the Universal Theatre, but I was thinking of that building, which had a whole lot of retail outlets and other things in it as well. So there's a, you know, so much, there was so much going on in Fitzroy at a time when, oddly enough, Collingwood, I think for a lot of people in Fitzroy, Collingwood in the 80s, Collingwood was sort of beyond the pale, you know, the outer suburbs. But Fitzroy was, it was most definitely happening, and the influence of a lot of the people who were kind of working and living in that area at the time, yes, they had a major impact.
Yeah.
On the wider culture, yeah.
David, thank you so much for helping us celebrate Brunswick Street today.
Thanks, Mary.
That's David Nichols, who is Professor of Urban Planning at Melbourne University. You're talking also, he's still coming in, Punters Club, Ministry of Sound Clothing Store. Glenn, you've called in from Bendigo. Can I ask you very briefly, what are your memories of it?
My memories are quite varied.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going back to the 1965-70s.
Mm-hmm.
I was an apprentice printer down there at the time, but
not as bohemian back then, Glenn.
Yours, love.
Not as hippie, not as bohemian back then.
No, actually, it was quite of the pits. There was some heavy industry. There was a stove. An ironworks manufacturing industry in Kerr Street.
Yeah.
We had the McRobertson's chocolate factory and, let's say, British United Shoe Machinery Company.
Yeah.
HSV 7 had a studio in Johnson Street up near the...
Yeah. Oh, Glenn, I think we've just lost you, but yes, so many parts of the culture that then I had to move out as well. Thank you so much, everybody, for leaning into the conversation. And if I can get back to some of these texts and calls, I will. It is 21 minutes to 12 now, though, and if you wanted to know about why the UAE leaving OPEC will make your life better. Please stick around. That is coming up this hour. But next, turns out that some of the worst stuff when it comes to kids' sport is not on the field. It's what's sitting in the gear bag in your kid's mouthguard. We will talk about what is on that mouthguard and how to properly clean it next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
On The Conversation Hour, I'm going to take you into your child's mouth guard, and it's 17 types of disgusting. We are now into that time where winter sport means that the mouth guards are in. How do we clean it? How best to clean it? And what is happening in that mouthguard in the first place? Hussein Sumer is the Swinburne biotechnology expert who's been looking deep into your child's mouthguard and can tell us the results. Thanks for joining us, Hussein.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to look at them in the first place?
Yeah, I guess I was at my kids' footy games and footy training and just saw how the kids were handling their mouth guards during a game. So maybe they'll pop them out of their mouth. When having a shot at goal, they might pop them in their sock or in their shorts, chewing on them. And it kind of got me thinking, I wonder how contaminated or disgusting they might be in terms of bacteria.
Oh, I love it. A weaponized dad. Yes. So what did you find?
Yeah, so what we decided to do was actually swab the mouth guards and look for bacteria, but this was actually before a training session. So we were working off the assumption that they must have been clean before they actually put them in their mouth before training. And what we did find was that there were, you know, tens of different types of bacteria on their mouth guards before they used them, and even in the cases as well.
Wow. So what you found that, in fact, none of them were clean in the first place?
That's right. So it implied that there was improper cleaning and hygiene practices after a game or after training. So, yeah, they were already dirty before they put them in their mouths.
And so how dangerous can that be?
Yeah, so I guess we found that, so we did swab their mouths and check what kind of bacteria is in the mouth. And essentially there are normal type of bacteria in the mouth, but on the mouth guards, there were bacteria that wasn't present in the mouth, and that was actually found in the environment. So things that were found in the soil or on plants were making their way into the mouth guards. And some of them had the potential to cause infectious diseases. So skin infections, respiratory infections, ear infections, so different types of bacteria.
Right, so not just infections in the mouth.
Correct, yeah.
And so how wide could that infection go? Did you say it was in the skin, it was throughout the body?
Yeah, that's right. So things like Staph aureus, Pseudomonas species, Enterobacter species, so these are all different types of bacteria that have the potential to cause disease. I'm not saying that they would have, but certainly could have that potential.
You're listening to The Gross Evidence that Hussein Sumer found. He's Swinburne biotechnology expert, and we're talking about children's mouthguards. How do you clean your child's mouthguard? 1300 222 774. Have you, like Hussein, looked at your kids and your kids' teammates with their mouth guards and thought, oh no, what do you do? So this is the question, Hussein. What do you believe is the best way to actually clean a mouth guard?
Yeah, so we did a quick little study and we actually contaminated clean sheets or worn sheets of EVA, the material that mouth guards are made of. We then either followed manufacturers' recommendations of just simple rinsing them, but we found the most effective way would be to use a toothbrush and some toothpaste or maybe a mild detergent and give them a good scrub.
Okay, how long for?
Oh, just for a minute or so, nothing too wild.
And so you're saying that that's not even what the manufacturers are suggesting?
Correct. Yeah, they're not even suggesting that. And another little side note that we found is if you look at a new mouth guard, you'll see it's nice and smooth. But over time, over a year or a season of use, the material actually degrades and becomes scratched up through constant chewing, you know, throwing it in the bag and whatnot. So those little microscopic scratches are little hiding spots for bacteria to colonize. So it kind of emphasizes that as the mouth guard is used and deteriorates, it becomes more prone to bacterial attachment. So we should really try and clean them thoroughly.
Is it, at that point, should we be throwing them away or replacing them?
Well, I guess, I mean, kids are growing, so they usually get new mouth guards every season. So that's probably a normal time frame to use one.
It is 14 minutes to 12, and we are talking about gross mouth guards. But also, I'm seeing on text a couple of people writing in saying how many people scrub out their water bottles too, and their drink bottles are also disgusting. Hussein, is that potentially your next area of study?
Yeah, I guess we've seen different people checking in on water bottles. So, you know, how often are we cleaning them? So I'm not being too alarmist and saying that they will cause infection, but certainly it's good to practice good hygiene.
What do you say to this on text, Hussein? Considering kids don't get into the dirt that much anymore, they're over-sanitized, maybe this is one way to boost their immune system again. Maybe using a grotty mouthguard might not be as bad as it seems. What do you think?
Well, I guess, you know, that's one perspective, but I guess, you know, there can be kids that have that are immune compromised. Maybe they're already, their immune system is a little bit down. So having this widespread recommendation to not clean them would be detrimental.
Indeed. I can see on text a fair bit of we're not being hysterical. And for the record, Hussein, you're saying you don't have to go over the top. Maybe just consider doing this from time to time.
Yeah, correct. I'm certainly not saying that it's going to be detrimental to anyone's health, but it's certainly something to be mindful of.
Have you changed your regime or, in fact, making your child do it themselves?
Yeah, that's right. So I kind of pointed out to the kids, you know, showed them the bacteria that we grew on the plate from their mouth guards and said, you know, this kind of stuff's on your mouth guards. So maybe wash it and clean it after use.
You're a popular dad.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, no, Dad just showed me what's in my mouth guard. I hope the rest of the parents of the team took it to heart as well. Hussein, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Cheers. Thanks for your time. Have a lovely day.
You too. That's Hussein Sumer, who is the Swinburne biotechnology expert who has shone a light into and on and around your child's mouthguard, and you'll never think of it the same again, will you? It is 12 minutes to 12 on the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I am still getting your texts about Brunswick Street. In the early 80s, bought my house there then, had a service station on the corner of Bell Street, had a wonderful Italian supermarket. Snake Pit Skateboard Shop is something else that you're bringing up. And Rumbarella's, T2, opening its first store in Brunswick Street in the 80s. Every nurse and doctor at St Vincent's went to Mario's morning, noon and night. We didn't need a menu to order. It was our kitchen and dining room. The waiters were so svelte in their waistcoat ties and long white aprons. I will get to more of your texts as we continue in the conversation hour. But coming up next, you might have heard the overnight news that the UAE is leaving OPEC. A couple of acronyms for you there. This is actually quite important. Yes, we're talking about the Emirates leaving OPEC, which was, of course, has been the central mechanism, at least in the 70s, for oil producers and consumers looking at the prices. What does it mean to you today in 2026 that the UAE is leaving OPEC? Saul Kavanagh is head of energy research at MST Marquee and joins us to explain. Hi, Saul.
Good morning.
Good morning. So for Pete, let's go back to basics. Let's talk about OPEC. It's changed in its significance to the oil market over time, hasn't it?
It certainly has. So if we go back, even as far back as, for example, the 1970s, OPEC really held all of the cards in the oil market. That started to change about a decade ago, particularly when the US shale revolution saw the United States become self-sufficient in oil and, in fact, a net oil exporter. And that's seen OPEC nations, particularly led by Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, and entering these price wars with the United States in a fight for market share over the last 10 years. And it's really put pressure on a number of OPEC members, in particular the UAE, which has been one of the contributing factors to see this quite shocking announcement from the UAE overnight that they are leaving the cartel, which they'd been probably the second most important member and most compliant member of for decades.
Mm. So as you say, it's a big deal. Can you explain in simple terms why?
Well, OPEC still controls a lot of the market, and they've had the ability to manage the market in their terms, but ultimately OPEC is incentivized to make oil prices higher, which for most of us in the rest of the world who are net consumers of oil is not good news. Mm. Now, the UAE leaving, in my opinion, this could be the beginning of the end of OPEC's cartel-like sway over global oil markets, mm. because the UAE was one of the most important and particularly the most compliant member. It's going to be a real struggle for Saudi Arabia to now actually keep the influence that OPEC once had. And what I think you'll see the UAE do now is they're actually going to plan to produce more oil. Now, that's not going to help us amidst this immediate crisis because the Strait of Hormuz is closed, so they can't actually export anymore at the moment. But past the Iran war, over the medium to longer term, this is going to be good news for us in Australia and most of the world, because we'll see more oil in the market, less influence from a cartel. And I think you'll start to see the United States and more Western-aligned nations, including the UAE, holding more sway over oil markets rather than more of the cartel-like behaviour we've seen over the last 50 years.
Mm. You're listening to Saul Kavanagh, who is Head of Energy Research at MST Marquee. You might have seen this news overnight that the UAE is leaving OPEC and thought, what's that got to do with me? Well, Saul's telling you that it could be very good news for all of us, at least if we're relying on oil, and we'll get to that. Saul, I saw it described as being maybe a move towards a free market rather than controlled scarcity. What you're saying is the UAE is wanting to take, you know, to up the amount of oil, as you said, after this conflict. Is it also a response to the UAE seeing that we might be less dependent on oil down the track and they really want to rush in and take advantage of what they've got?
No, absolutely that is the case. So if you look at the UAE's really leadership in having quite, I guess, a progressive outlook for the oil markets, but also in diversifying its economy away from oil much more rapidly than many of the other OPEC member states. I think that's part of the trend we've seen from the UAE leadership here, where they realise it's probably better to produce more now than later, mm-hmm. Precisely because the longer-term demand outlook could be more uncertain. But this is also feeding into some of the geopolitics that's going on. There's been an increasing rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia across a number of fronts that's emerged in the last few years. The Iran war has, for the UAE, been a wake-up call that a lot of its neighbour Gulf states haven't stepped up to protect it as much as it hoped. And I think you're seeing the UAE actually look to move closer, for example, to the United States here, and really diversify not just its oil market options, but its geostrategic options as well.
Mm. I guess when, let's be really parochial and self-centred, when might this, how long would it take for the UAE to get out of this? Obviously, after the war, after, you know, it can actually produce, how long would it take them to produce more oil in such a way as it affects us at the bowser?
Well, the good news is that the UAE has close to 5 million barrels a day capacity compared to it's only been producing about 3.5 million barrels prior to the war. This is because of the quotas and the restrictions it's had on its output under OPEC. So as soon as we see a normalisation of flow after the war, the UAE could increase supply by 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day, which is 1 to 1.5% of the entire global supply. That's actually going to be really important because after this war, because of the disruption that's happened, we are looking at higher for longer oil prices than, say, we were expecting back in January. But the UAE's ability to do this could really mitigate that in quite a meaningful way and help us get back down to more affordable prices we saw prior to the war beginning.
Sol, thank you for explaining to us, I guess, a little bit of a bright note on the fuel crisis topic. Thank you.
Indeed, cheers.
Sol Kavanic, Head of Energy Research at MST Marquee. We, of course, we're talking about Brunswick Street this hour. Jackie, you've called in from Swan Hill. What are your memories?
I just remember being a really poor student, and wherever I lived, whether it was Brunswick or Ivanhoe, we would jump in our really crappy car and drive there. And it would just be so wonderful to go and get a ice cream at Charmaine's or to have some food at the veggie bar. To go to the hat shop, which I can't remember the hat shop. Someone will remember that. But one day I saw a Sigrid Thornton there, which was just such a treat. The Black Cat Cafe and the Southern School of Natural Therapies was around the corner. So I think it gave a really interesting vibe. So the suburb was full of, you know, cheap accommodation in terraces, and there were galleries, and there were no nightclubs back then, which made it better. And the highlight also was Babka, which incredibly still persists.
Yeah, exactly. Do you go back, Jackie, still?
I do, but not very often because now I live in the country.
Yeah. A bit hard.
And it has lost a bit of its charm, I sadly.
Oh. Well, Jackie, controversial note to end on, but thank you for everybody who has joined that conversation. Yes, Babka, lots of people agreeing with you there as well. Talk to you tomorrow.